Hi, everybody. It's Dr. Amy Myers with the Myers Way podcast. Sorry that it's been a while since I've been on. I've been working on my book, The Autoimmune Solution, but I'm back on track and I have the best guest today on our podcast. I have Dr. Jeff Bland, who has recently written The Disease Delusion, which we're going to talk about. But first, I want to tell you about Dr. Bland. If you're not familiar with him, this is really an exciting podcast for me. He actually founded the Institute of Functional Medicine back in 1991 with his wife. And over the last 35 years, he's traveled more than 6 million miles, teaching over 100,000 health practitioners in the U.S. and Canada and over 40 other countries all about functional medicine. He has a degree in biology and chemistry and a PhD in organic chemistry. He's authored over 100 scientific publications and 10 books, and recently founded in 2012 the Personalized Lifestyle Medicine Institute. So please welcome the father of functional medicine, Dr. Jeff Bland.
Well, Dr. Myers, thanks. What a pleasure to be with you and your listeners today. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I always talk every time I do my podcast that I'm excited about my guests, but really this is, you know, you're the cream of the crop. So I could not be more thrilled to have you here today. Where I'd like to start, I know we're going to be talking about your book, which I've read and it's fabulous. Congratulations. It's really exciting. But where I really like to start is kind of how you got into all of this. I mean, you are considered the father of functional medicine. I am, you know, so grateful to you for starting the Institute of Functional Medicine, which is where I've done all of my training, and it has changed my life and the lives of all of my patients. So I'm curious of how you got into that.
Yeah, I think that for all of us, our paths in life are really kind of interesting. When we look back in retrospect, there are probably things that come out of our experiences that are different than we would have intended or planned. And that's kind of what happened with me. I was very interested in science, obviously, and I intended on really going on to medical school and going into practice and being kind of your traditional doc. I got kind of waylaid as I graduated out of college, went on to medical school, and in my transition was I kept asking the question of my instructors, why do people get these illnesses? Now, this was back in the 60s, the 1960s, and so there wasn't a whole lot known really about the cause of heart disease or diabetes or of arthritis or a myriad of other types of chronic illnesses. So the answer was always given to me, well, you'll have a lifetime to explore that, but right now you just need to attend to what we're learning here in school, which is differential diagnosis and treatment of the signs and symptoms. And I think for me, that was just not an intellectually satisfying answer. So I kept probing the question. And finally, my advisor in medical school said, you know, it might be good for you to the place that you can really be reinforced for asking all these questions is to get a PhD. Why don't you step over and do some PhD work, and you can ask any questions you want. You're kind of reinforced for that in a PhD program. So I really made the transition in my third year of medical school over to a PhD program, and I really found my home there because it was a place where I could explore a lot of these questions as it relates to the whys rather than the whats of disease. And then from that, ultimately, it led me into an academic position. I became a certified clinical laboratory director in hospital-based medicine. That gave me an opportunity then to start really looking at real patients as it relates to some of these early warning signs of disease. And from then it was kind of history, research at the university, publication, eventually becoming the president of the Northwest Academy of Preventive Medicine. I owned a medical laboratory that served about 10 physicians in the Seattle area. And then a sabbatical in the early 80s with my longtime kind of mentor, one of my great guides, Dr. Linus Pauling, two-time Nobel Prize winner. I spent 2 years on sabbatical with him in his research institute in Stanford in the early 80s. And then from that, decided that my calling in life was really to help docs to understand how to apply preventive medicine more effectively in their practices. So I started a company in 1984 called HealthCom that was really focused on doctor education. And then from that, the Institute for Functional Medicine was born in 1990-91. So that's a kind of a thumbnail sketch as to what got me to where we are today.
It's so funny. I'm just over here smiling where they're like, well, if you want to ask questions, don't be a doctor, go be a researcher. I mean, you know, what kind of thought process is going on there? It's exactly, you know, how we are trained in medicine. Here's this, give you that. And I think it's wonderful that you have now taught, you know, hundreds of thousands through, you know, teach one, others teach others about really asking the questions of the why. I mean, I think that's the number one question that I ask in my clinic now is why? Why did somebody get this? Why did somebody get that? And then the how. So I appreciate that you bridged that gap. You went over to the research side and now you're teaching physicians to ask the whys.
Yeah, I think it's very fascinating, Amy, when I look at what's gone on over the last 25 years since the inception of the Institute for Functional Medicine. You know, when we had our first formational meetings, which actually we sponsored in up in Victoria in British Columbia on Vancouver Island, we brought in 25 what I thought were really extraordinary thought leaders in medicine, people like Dr. David Jones, Dr. Leo Gallen, Dr. Sidney Baker, Dr. Joe Pizzorno, Dr. Graham Reedy. There were about 25 individuals from different disciplines, including a variety of kind of thought leaders out of traditional medicine, people that were dealing with systems biology and dealing with also all sorts of kind of connected areas that weren't really talking to one another. And when we sat down for 2 days in Victoria with just a whiteboard saying, what would be an ideal situation if we were to have the best of all worlds in medicine? And we started carving out that kind of definition. It was fascinating for me to see how ideas started to germinate when we freed all of us up from, you know, our conventions and our particular types of pedagogy or our background. And we just worked collaboratively under this kind of utopian concept of what would the best medicine look like and how would we frame it. Out then popped the concept of functional medicine, which we I came up actually the third day of this meeting. I remember having this kind of aha experience that night sleeping about that we should call this functional medicine. And I tried that on with the docs there and the people at the meeting, and everyone thought, well, that sounds like a pretty good term because dysfunction precedes illness. So maybe what we're really talking about is measuring people's function more than measuring their disease, because diseases are really kind of a way station for a level of dysfunction that ultimately gets a person into the hospital. So maybe we need to go earlier and look at dysfunction or lack of function that occurs much earlier, so we would know how to personalize the program for the individual to prevent them from going to the hospital. So that was the kind of birthing of the concept of functional medicine and the wonderful intellectual environment that it was born out of these extraordinary thought leaders.
And do you feel that it's caught on? I mean, is it where you thought it would be now? Did it catch on more quickly or more slowly? Because, I mean, just in the last 4 years that I've been going to the symposiums and all the trainings, I mean, it's exploded. And just from my own practice, the number of people in my first year of practice would Google holistic medicine or integrative medicine. And now the number of people that actually are seeking out the word functional medicine and they know what it is has, I mean, it's incredible. Just the amount of people that know that term now. What are your thoughts about it? Is it more than you expected? Not what you expected?
Well, I think you stated it. I think that when you birth an idea, you never know how it's going to be sticky, to use a Malcolm Gladwell term. You don't know if anyone else is going to think this is a good idea or not. And with any new idea, you put it out there at first. And as you know well, there was already a concept of what functional medicine meant in medicine. It had been defined really as either geriatric medicine or as psychosomatic medicine, meaning it was conditions that were in your mind, not real. And so we had to kind of overcome a stereotype, a bias against the term functional medicine, the way we were using it, which is a way that really refers to early stage, I would call preceding disease. And I think it was probably 10 years of kind of just heavy lifting, trying to get the message out. And, you know, there was a period there from 1990 to 2000 that we weren't sure, you know, how much affiliation we would ultimately get with the term. But thanks to extraordinary work that the staff of the Institute of Functional Medicine has done over those years and the extraordinary number of thought leaders like yourself who are really innovators that have stepped in to both not only understand the concept, but to take it to the next level, I think it's starting to get what they call the knee of the hockey stick. It's starting to really expand remarkably. And in fact, as you know, this last weekend in the New York Times, There was a very nice article written about Dr. Mark Hyman, who is the chairman of IFM, and I'm very proud to say was one of our first people that we kind of recruited into the Institute for Functional Medicine back 20 years ago when he was just coming out of emergency room medicine. And this article on Dr. Hyman in the New York Times really talks about the success that he's had with the implementation of functional medicine in fairly noteworthy patients like Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton and others. And so I think we are starting to see a rising tide of understanding that this concept, whatever you want to call it, this systems biology concept of looking at how people got ill and their narrative, their story, more than just what they have, is how they got it, so we can understand what to do with it at the cause rather than the effect level, is really starting to catch on. And that, of course, that was the whole theme of why I wrote The Disease Delusion, was to try to really take these experiences that I'd had over the last 30 plus years and make them understandable, hopefully at some level, to the health conscious consumer, so they could see how this could affect their lives in a positive way.
Right. Yeah. No, that was an excellent article about Mark. It was. I meant to post it on my Facebook page. Thanks for the reminder, just to spread the message even further. It was a really, I think, a good tribute to him as well as, you know, all of functional medicine. So that's a great segue into your newest book, The Disease Delusion, Conquering the Cause of Chronic Illness for a Healthier, Longer, Happier Life. So, you know, as you've talked about, we've really had all these advances in medicine over the years, but we're seeing such a rise in chronic illnesses. So, I mean, how it seems sort of the antithesis or the opposite. How can that be? You know, we've made all these advances, yet in a way, we're actually a sicker population than ever.
Yeah, I think you really said it. It is a paradox. I think it's one of the most remarkable paradoxes. I mean, we're living in the best of all times and the worst of all times, to kind of coin terms from The Tale of Two Cities and Dickens. The worst of all times is that we are actually seeing the rising tide, as you said, of these chronic diseases like type 2 diabetes and dementia at rates that are really quite extraordinary. And it's not just because we're an aging population, because these conditions like type 2 diabetes and non-alcoholic fatty liver disease and gout and things that are associated with insulin resistance are being seen in earlier and younger age individuals down into the teenage years now. And we've been told this is all a consequence of obesity. But quite honestly, there is no direct link between obesity and these conditions. There's an association, but you can't find a high statistical correlation. The obesity may be actually the effect and not the cause of these problems. There may be something underlying the things that we see that are all interconnected. So we can't say because you're fat, you get diabetes. What we can say is you get fat and you get diabetes as a consequence of some other functional disturbance in your physiology. We call it disturbed metabolism. And that begs the question then, what is it that causes these things to happen? What would cause the ever-increasing rise of dementia, even in people that are in their 40s and 50s, that seems to be epic in proportion? What would cause things like autistic spectrum disorder, which is certainly increased dramatically since I was in medical school in the 60s. What would cause the ever-increasing rise of various types of autoimmune disease like systemic lupus erythematosus or SLE in women? These are questions that are really, I think, extraordinarily important, because if you look at the United States on World Health Organization rating scale, we're like 34th in health outcomes, and yet we spend almost twice per capita on healthcare of the rest of these leading countries. So we're spending more and getting less in terms of health outcomes. So why is that? Well, I think the answer, as you've talked to your listeners and your patients over the years, is because we're using the wrong model for these chronic illnesses. We're using the model that was developed for acute illnesses. So the acute illness is you treat the diagnosis with heroic intervention. It could be surgery, could be pharmaceuticals or a combination. And if it's successful, the patient gets well and they go back to life. With a chronic illness, however, because there's not a single cause. There are multiple causes, and there's not a single set of genes that cause diabetes. It's a complex array of genes and lifestyle. One pill won't do it. One treatment won't be successful. You need a comprehensive intervention that's personalized to that individual need. It has to be a whole different model. And there is the functional medicine model. That's what it was developed and designed to do, is to address these more complex problems for which there's not a single answer to the cause. You have to look at the patient's story, their history, their genealogy, their lifestyle, and then you, like a detective, like Sherlock Holmes, you piece that together and you understand the individual's own cause of those conditions, and you can remediate that, not with a single pill, but with a complex personalized approach. And the outcomes of that type of strategy are just extraordinary. I mean, you know it best being an expert in this field, but you know, we used to see over 4,000 patient visits a year in our research clinic in Washington State, and the number of miracles, in quote, that we saw by implementing this functional medicine model across a whole array of chronic illnesses was just truly spectacular. It was remarkable. So I think that the disease delusion, the book, was really written as a consequence of trying to demonstrate that we have been on a model over the last 30 or 40 years. It's really great. Yeah, I'm talking about a medical model. It's really great if a person has an acute illness. But if they have a chronic illness that goes on for and progresses for decades of living, we need a different approach. And that approach is the functional medicine approach. And when we change our strategy, we change the outcome. And we can release people from this kind of vicious cycle of chronic illness.
Yeah, you may not know this about me. I actually was trained as an ER physician as well, because I went into medicine with the idea that I would do functional medicine, but I didn't know it existed when I went into medicine. And I actually spent some time with Andrew Weil and thought I would do integrative medicine and just didn't get to the root. So I picked emergency medicine because I knew it was the only thing that I could do. I knew that the rest of medicine was treating it, in my opinion, incorrectly. And so, you know, there is that need for the, you know, catastrophic acute care when you're in a car accident or you're shot or something like that. And it wasn't until, you know, I met Mark Hyman that I heard about functional medicine, and then that, you know, spiraled and completely changed my life. And thankfully, because of you, I had a place to go get training for it. But I completely, you know, agree about, you know, how we are doing it so incorrectly. And you mention in the book about seven sort of core physiological processes that affect, you know, every organ, and that's really the heart of what's making us sick. Can you kind of tell us about those and go in a little detail about each of those?
Yes, I think that that is a real interesting story. I've talked about the worst of all worlds, which is this rising tide of chronic illness, but I didn't really do a good job of balancing that with the best of all worlds. What's the best of all worlds? Well, at this particular age we're living, we are right now involved with the most remarkable medical breakthroughs and discoveries, probably comparable or maybe even greater than that of what happened at the turn of the last century, when the cause of infectious disease was discovered, you know, the concept that bugs can cause disease. If you recall in medical history, before the early 1900s or the late 1800s, early 1900s, all these plagues and things like tuberculosis and diphtheria and typhoid and, you know, even simple things that are sometimes not so simple like the flu, the origin of those were not understood at all. And then as a consequence of, you know, these discoveries that were made by people ultimately, like Louis Pasteur and others, we got the understanding that these diseases that were the major killer diseases of the age were caused by microbes, by bacteria, these small little submicroscopic things. And we could actually develop treatments for them. First, there was immunotherapy, the Jenner and Koch, and also later past year, and then following on to that, the birthing of the modern pharmaceutical industry with Alexander Fleming and the discovery of penicillin, and the treatment with the first real successful drugs for the major diseases, which were bacterial diseases. So that was a tremendous discovery breakthrough at the turn of the last century. But now we've kind of sat the last nearly 100 years waiting for the next major scientific breakthrough that would help us to have the same success in managing these more complex chronic illnesses that have grown up to be the dominant diseases of today that constitute about 78% of our healthcare expenditures. And fortunately, this is the best of all worlds, that the turn of the 21st century, we're now seeing this revolution occur. It's absolutely extraordinary to see what is emerging in a day-by-day basis by scientists and clinicians who are discovering the origin of chronic illness as it relates to how our lifestyles and our environment interact with our genes. And this, in part, came out of the Human Genome Project, and where people were actually able to, for the first time, understand something about our book of life. I call it our book of life. It's really the most precious thing we own, which is our human genome, all our genetic history that's locked into every cell of our body. And before, it used to be a mystery book, but now people have been able to decipher its code, and we start to understand something about our uniqueness. And, you know, at first people were involved with this exploration and discoveries thought we were going to discover the origin of all diseases by specific genes. So we'd find the gene for diabetes and the gene for heart disease and the gene for whatever bad dayism or whatever the disease of the day was. And lo and behold, that's not what we found. What was found in the deciphering the human genome was that there were no specific genes for these chronic illnesses. There were complex arrays of genes that would work together as families to control our function in response to our environment. And so therefore, in some senses, as we read our book of life into how we look, act, and feel, it's a consequence of where we're reading our book. If we read our book in a good nutrition, low pollution, low stress environment, it expresses the stories of karmic love and bliss that we call good health. If we read our book of life over under great distress, we've got chronic infections, we have poor nutrition, we're in an environment that's exposing us to all sorts of toxic chemicals, then a different set of chapters out of our book of life or stories are read. By the way, these stories are called our genes, and those become the stories of disease. So when people ask the question, well, doesn't it really mean that disease is inevitable? My answer to that question is what we've learned from this extraordinary discovery discoveries that have been made over the last 25 years is that our health genes will trump our disease genes. If we really do the right things that are unique to our genetic needs, that lo and behold, we'll find that those disease genes that sit within our book of life can be silent, and our health genes can be amplified and loud and clear. And so the real, I think, extraordinary discovery of the 21st century is to recognize that these chronic illnesses that we often say are, well, my father had heart disease, so I'll have heart disease, or my mother had breast cancer, so I'll have breast cancer, is actually kind of not based on good science. What we recognize is that our genes probably constitute as hardwired contributors to disease only about 25%. It's a 75% factor that's variable, which has to do with how we send messages to our genes, our lifestyle, diet, exercise patterns, workplace environment, the things in exposure to radiation, all these variables. What's the good news is those are modifiable. So the key of good health is syncing up our variables, the things that we can control, with our genetic uniqueness. And that really is the functional medicine model, is saying once we get those aligned, once we find the right recipe or formula for our life, lo and behold, health isn't a mystery. It becomes a dominant feature of our function.
And you and I know that. And I was reading, you know, your book, looking at, I mean, I knew about the autism and how, you know, it, over the last, you know, it used to be 1 in 8,000, and over the last 50 years, it's gone to 1 in 50. But you have a statistic in there about the BRCA gene. And before 1940, it was 24% of people would get, you know, breast cancer. And now by 2013, 85%. And so it makes me just go back to, you know, when Angelina Jolie had her bilateral mastectomy, and just all of the, you know, comments, support, the non-support, things like that, and just thinking, yeah, we need to get the word out about this, about it really is about epigenetics and how diet and lifestyle influence these genes rather than the gene itself. Because, you know, in my opinion, I didn't voice any opinion, but my opinion on the sidelines was, wow, that likely was unnecessary, and it's a matter of everything that you just talked about.
Yeah, I think these are really very personal questions, aren't they? Because when we're dealing with the intimacy of health, it comes down to a lot of a belief system that a person carries about whether they feel health is a mystery or whether disease is inevitable. You know, we have these different kind of senses that we carry with us about our own personal advocacy. I think that what is occurring right now as a consequence of these discoveries, however, is to energize people to the recognition that they have a lot more control over their health as they age than they used to think they had. We all in school, probably about the eighth grade, every student in the eighth grade took some kind of a health science course or biology course in which they learned about Mendel, you know, the P's and genetic dominant and recessive characteristics. And we all came away feeling that our future was all fixed in our genes. It was locked in. It was determined. And there was little we could do about it. And if we just happened to get the bad genes, woe is us, you know, that we're just going to have to deal with the fact we got the bad luck of the draw. But I believe that now we're seeing this story changed remarkably. It's not that we don't have dominant recessive genes. It's not that genes are unimportant. They are important. But the way that they can be expressed into our how we look, act, and feel is much more variable than we thought about, and that or we previously thought. And I believe that this will give a tremendous advocacy for patients to work with their healthcare providers to work as a team to find the right program to prevent these disorders that really shouldn't start affecting our lives adversely when we're 40 or 50 or 60 or even 70 years of age. You asked the question, what are the core processes that regulate our function over time? And I think these exciting discoveries have distilled down into basically seven core processes. And those are the processes that I try to focus on in the book to help the reader to understand how they are having an influence on health as we age and how they are individualized to a person's own genetics and lifestyle and background. So that if we talk about gastrointestinal function, that's one of the processes. If we talk about detoxification, that's another of the processes. If we talk about energy by what's called bioenergetics, that's another. If we talk about skeletal integrity or what's called physical function, that's another. If we talk about cellular communication and how hormones interface and signal for the body's organs and tissues to function and repair themselves, that's another. So by looking at each of these seven core processes, which is each one is discussed in a separate chapter of the book, and there's a questionnaire that precedes each of these chapters, it helps a person to kind of understand where might they find themselves on this sequence of events that we're getting to, in other words, of their basic function, their strengths and weaknesses. The objective here is not to make people who are reading the book into experts in either functional medicine or anatomy and physiology, but help them to understand that they control a lot more than they probably believed as it relates to their health outcomes by understanding a little bit more about their body and its interrelationship with their genes and their environment.
So apparently we have 25,000 genes and 3 million SNPs, and I think this is really the core of what you're talking about. I mean, it's these seven physiologic, you know, influences, but it's their influence on these various SNPs. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would turn it around slightly the other way. I would say that there are 3 million variations of the letters of our genetic code from person to person. That's called those single nucleotide polymorphisms or SNPs, SNPs that you mentioned. And so it's a lot more variety of difference from person to person than was expected when the Human Genome Project was first initiated. You know, we all kind of say, well, gee, humans are kind of similar. You know, we might have different skin color, hair color, eye color, but we've got, you know, most of us 10 fingers and 10 toes and a nose and 2 eyes. And you know, we look reasonably similar to one another. So, you know, we must be functioning very, very similar to one another. So it was quite a remarkable part of this discovery when they started deciphering differences between one person's genome and another, that they found that there were these 3 million variations on a theme, subtle variations that we call SNPs. And that kind of threw a wild card into the the belief that we are all very similar, therefore we could all be treated with the same drug. We could have blockbuster drugs called statins that everybody could take and they would all respond the same, and or we could all take blood pressure medication or whatever and we'd get similar results. Lo and behold, we found there were that one patient or one person might vary in their response to a specific drug by a factor of 1,000 from another, meaning the dose of one could produce an effect that was 1,000 times different of that same dose in another person. And that was like, whoa, this is a whole different view of medicine than we previously had. And in fact, it may explain why there are so many people that have adverse drug reactions, because if there's that much variety from person to person and we're treating all people with the same medication, then gee whiz, we're just asking for trouble. And I think this is a paradigm shifting, or let's call it a very big landscape shifting concept. And when we start applying that to the individual person and say, well, what do I do? Well, it reminds us things like diet. We, you know, everyone says, what's the perfect diet? Well, there is no the perfect diet. I mean, the food for one can be the poison of another. We know this kind of from our experience, but it didn't seem to get coded very well into our ways that we treat patients. So often we are given a patient is given a diet plan saying, well, this is the same diet plan I use in every patient. This should work for you. Well, some people don't do well on vegetarian diets. Some people don't do well on diets that are high in protein. Some people don't do well on diets that are high in complex carbohydrates. Other people don't do well on diets that are high in lipids, so you have, or fats. So you have to really know how to individualize them. We know that some people, if you give them gluten, they're going to end up with autoimmune disease. So gee whiz, you know, gluten is just a protein found in grains. Why do some people have such an adverse immune response that for them it could actually produce a serious condition like MS, multiple sclerosis? So I think these are the stories that are emerging out of these 21st century discoveries that are going to really help us to manage these unexpected health problems that people encounter. They say, I don't know where they came from. Maybe it was just my bad genes. Well, no, it wasn't bad genes. It was not matching an individual's uniqueness with what they need for optimal health.
I'm so glad you mentioned about the diet, because I actually had that down as a question. But I completely agree with you. I always get asked about that. And I say there is no one right diet. You'll see people thriving on a, you know, raw diet or a vegan diet. And other people, you know, say it was the worst. You know, that was what caused them to be sick. And other people doing well on a paleo diet and vice versa. So I completely agree. And I'm looking forward to our, you know, the conversations at the symposium this year about, you know, sort of various types of diets. But that gets back to, you know, I think, you know, a lot of people say, or some of the comments that I'll get from people occasionally, they're going to see their other doctors. And as you can imagine, I see very, very chronically ill people, extremely sensitive. You know, they come in and they're taking a supplement, or they'll take a supplement and have a reaction. And they'll say, you know, could that be? I was like, well, I haven't ever had anybody tell me that, but I believe you that that could be doing it to you. We're all individuals. So even though, you know, 400 other patients have never had that reaction, that, you know, completely is possible. But what I wanted to mention or have a conversation around was, you know, a lot of my patients have SNPs at MTHFR, so I have them on really high dosages of, you know, premethylated B vitamins and folinic acid, and maybe they're still continuing to see another doctor, and they'll bring their supplement bottles, and they're just, you know, horrified that they're, you know, 100 times the USDA, you know, or the recommended daily allowance. So kind of let's talk about that from, you know, how did we get the RDA level of nutrients, and why is it, which is sort of like the diet, I'm assuming, that we don't all need the same amount?
Yeah, I think that's a very, very good example of this whole concept of individualization and difference of one person to another. So if you go back and study the history of the development of what was originally called the MDRs, that was a minimum daily requirements, and then they later became the RDAs, which then became the RDIs, reference dietary intake. We've had this transition occurring actually since World War II. So the MDRs were the level of vitamins and minerals that were established by the Food and Nutrition Board of the U.S. government to meet the needs of practically all healthy people to prevent a nutrient deficiency. So they were the amount of vitamin C that would prevent scurvy, or the amount of vitamin D that would prevent rickets, or the amount of vitamin B3 that would prevent pellagra. And those levels were really discovered by studies that were done on medical students, and at this point, this was back in the 30s and 40s, on prisoners that were in prisons, and were found that a certain restriction of them of these nutrients for a period of time would produce these deficiency symptoms, and they would give them back the vitamins or the minerals and see how much it took to treat that condition. And that became ultimately the MDR. And this was very important during the war because a lot of service people obviously were living off rations and prepackaged foods. And there was nutrient problems that were occurring particularly in individuals that had been out in the field for a long period of time. So they had to start fortifying the foods. That was the first really birthing of food fortification was during World War II. And then from that, ultimately, people said, well, you know, there is a difference among people, so maybe we shouldn't have one number, just like a minimum daily amount. We have a margin of difference from one person to another, so we ought to give a safety margin of a few, you know, some percent. So that became the recommended dietary allowances, or the RDAs, that most of us learn about on the back of cereal boxes, and, percent of RDA. And over the last probably 15 to 20 years, it's found that maybe the RDAs were not really probably proper in defining individual needs for nutrients, that we ought to look at a reference dietary intake or a reference daily value that would give us a range of what might be considered to be appropriate intake of these vitamins and minerals. And that became the RDI, which was kind of born out of the RDA, which we now see on the back of cereal boxes, the RDI. Well, none of these particular ways of evaluating nutrient need were built on the concepts that you and I are talking about, which is what is the level of a nutrient necessary or desirable for a person to promote optimal health? These were the levels of nutrients that are necessary to prevent a nutrient deficiency. Now, I think it's important to prevent a nutrient deficiency, so I would certainly say that's a first step. But beyond a nutrient deficiency is the level of a nutrient that's necessary for an individual to promote optimal function or optimal health. And then that begs the question, is there a difference between those two? Is the amount that prevents a nutrient deficiency any different than the amount of a nutrient that is optimal for producing health? And there is where the studies have been really focused for the last 20 years, is trying to define the difference between the prevention of scurvy and the optimal function relative to vitamin C or whatever the nutrient might be. And I think these discoveries have led us to understand that the range of difference from person to person in the level of intake of a nutrient to promote optimal function is much greater than we originally had thought when we set either the MDR or the RDA or the RDI. So this leads us from the difference of a public health model, because the RDA and the RDI are like public health guidelines to prevent nutritional deficiency, to an individual nutritional prescription model, which is what do you need, Amy Myers or Jeff Bland, for specific nutrients at different phases of your life to promote optimal function. And I think this is the cutting edge of where nutrition and where medicine is going. Unfortunately, you know this better than I. I was a medical school professor for 13 years, so I think I can say this with some history of experience. We don't teach medical students who go on to become docs much about nutrients and their relationship to function. We teach them a little bit, in probably a few hours in their whole training, about how to recognize nutrient deficiencies like scurvy, pellagra, xerothalmia, anemias, protein insufficiencies, and so forth. But we don't teach them much at all, if anything, about how to evaluate patients for optimal nutritional status and what level an individual needs of specific vitamins, minerals, amino acids, fatty acids, whatever, to promote optimal health. So that's the big gap in knowledge, which fortunately organizations like the Institute for Functional Medicine, with its nutrition curriculum, are starting to fill that gap and help docs to understand this difference between a level of a nutrient that's necessary to prevent a deficiency and the level of a nutrient in an individual that promotes optimal function. How do you measure that? How do you understand it? How do you design diets around optimal versus adequate? And ultimately, I would say this then helps us to move very strongly towards the prevention and I think prevention is the right word, of these chronic illnesses. Let me give one last example. There is an annual award that's given for the top nutrition researcher in the United States called the McCollum Award. And it goes to very highly published innovators in nutritional science. A few years ago, this award was given to Dr. Robert Heaney, who is an endocrinology professor of medicine at the medical school in Iowa. And he has done a tremendous amount of work in osteoporosis and vitamin D and calcium, and is known as an extraordinary contributor to our better understanding of how to prevent osteoporosis. And in his McCollum Award address, in which he was talking about his some 40 years of experience in the field, he talked about what are called long latency nutritional insufficiency diseases. And he said, in medicine, what we have focused on are short latency diseases. These are diseases where you take away a nutrient like vitamin C, and in a fairly short period of time, a matter of a few weeks, if you completely remove vitamin C from a person's diet, they'll start to get the signs of scurvy. And so we're really good at understanding these kind of acute diseases that come from short-term nutritional deficiency. What he pointed out, however, is that most of the nutritional related diseases are not short-term. They have long latency. They come on over years from not acute deficiency, but insufficiency. And he says the names of these diseases are osteoporosis, diabetes, various forms of heart disease, dementia. These long latency nutritional insufficiency diseases are the ones that are most complicated to diagnose and also the most important clinically. And most doctors are never trained to even understand the relationship. And I think that was a very, very insightful observation by Dr. Heaney, because when you start looking at the role that nutrients play in health, it's much more than just prevention of scurvy, beriberi, pellagra, xerothalmia, and rickets. It is really related to the whole support of the body's physiological system, these seven core physiological processes that I describe in the book, and how nutrients are individualized in their need to that person's based upon their health and genetic background to promote optimal health. So this is the frontier of the new medicine, is understanding and applying this knowledge, as I think you and your functional medicine colleagues are now doing, to really use nutrition in a much more what I would call 21st century way, not the 20th century way of just looking for the absence of nutrient deficiency.
Yeah, that was a great explanation. I don't think people understand, you know, they hear that we get some minimal nutrition in medical school. And I said, you don't understand that it's really talking about, you know, vitamin C and scurvy. It's not even talking about, you know, fats and carbohydrates. I mean, when I say minimal nutrition, it is, you know, extremely minimal. So how do you think, you know, we as a society are going to go forward? I mean, obviously, those of us in functional medicine, this is what we are practicing. We're doing sophisticated functional testing to see, you know, the amount of nutrients that people need. We're doing SNP testing. But how is that going to translate, or how could it even possibly translate onto, you know, an RDA recommendation or, you know, a line item sticker on the back of a food about how much is needed? I mean, how are we going to mesh those worlds?
Oh boy, that's a superb question. And that question is on the minds of many, many, many policymakers and people that are involved with public policy as it relates to nutrition and health. And in fact, there is a serious discussion going on right now among the body politic in nutrition regulations and nutrition legislation that we may be at the end of the era of providing this kind of RDI information, because now it's seen to be so limiting relative to these questions that we are talking about now, that there has actually been the suggestion that we should eliminate this entirely because it's not useful in managing the general health and nutrition related issues that we're confronted with today. So I think that the point that you're making is really the nature of what is occurring, as I would call this extraordinary revolution that we're all engaged in right now. Some of us don't know we're engaged in it, but we are. This revolution in thinking that's coming out of the discoveries from the Human Genome Project. Let me give an illustration of what's happening. Just since 2000, the year 2000, when the deciphering of the human genome was you know, presented in the Rose Garden with President Clinton there. So in those 14 years, not fully 14 years, what we have witnessed is a remarkable change in the technology of studying and analyzing people's genes. In 2000, the first human genome that was deciphered, the expense to have it deciphered was probably something on the order of $2 billion, if you were to sum up all of the costs. Today, 2014, the cost of doing that same procedure is now now under $1,000. So it went from over $1 billion to under $1,000 to do the same analysis over the last 14 years. This is what's in computer science called Moore's Law, meaning you see this exponential doubling of computing power over time. Well, now we're seeing an exponential doubling of gene testing capability over a very short period of time. And what that is doing is making accessible now this information at a cost that's going to be equivalent to about a standard laboratory test. Like if you went down and had a $100 laboratory test done at your doctor's office, you know, that'll be about the cost of what it's going to cost to decipher the whole genome. And simultaneous with that is the development of what's called informatics, or the ability of high computing power to actually analyze and understand what some of these genetic variations mean in terms of individual patient or individual needs, health needs. Now, what am I really saying? This sounds almost like sci-fi that I'm talking, you know, 100 years from now. I'm not talking 100 years from now. If you look at the Fitbit, or you look at some of these new devices that people are wearing to measure certain aspects of their fitness and their what are called biometric analyses, those tools that we're going to measure, or we're going to wear, and they'll be wearable devices, we'll start measuring certain aspects of our physiology on a real-time basis, things like blood sugar and things about fitness levels and sleep patterns. And it will it'll send that data directly into the cloud that will connect together with our genomic information that we'll all have, because it's going to be so inexpensive that everybody will have this as a universal lab test. They'll have their human genome kind of stored privately in the cloud, and it'll make these connections and start informing people as to what they need to do precisely to start optimizing their function and reducing the risk of metabolic disturbances associated with disease. Now that's, you say, well, Jeff, aren't you way out there in the cyberspace, out there in the ether? And my answer is no. We're talking about revolutions that are rapidly occurring, doubling times of just a few years, that within our, easily within the next 10 years, we're going to have these technologies that will be available and be utilized. Then the question is, how is that going to drive medical thinking? How is it going to drive reimbursement? How is it going to drive patient advocacy? Because this obviously brings the person directly into contact with their own health information and their own sense of control. So the relationship they're going to have with their doctors will change. The relationship they're going to have with healthcare providers and insurance companies under the Affordable Health Care Act. I mean, we're talking about a major shifting paradigm in healthcare. And that information starts, or let's call it that revolution, starts with people being able to ask the right questions. Because if you don't ask questions, you never get answers. In fact, the questions we ask determine the answers that we get in life. It's a general principle. So this is really one of the themes of the book, The Disease Delusion, to help people to understand how to ask the right questions. And because in the end, we all are going to find that we own our health and we have some degree of responsibility in navigating through this complex matrix and this new technology and the relationship to the docs of the future, of which you are one of those that represents the docs that we'll see in the future that are going to help the patient ask and answer the right questions, is going to transform healthcare and beat back this extraordinary cost spiral that we're seeing, this inflationary spiral in healthcare in which people are paying more and getting sicker.
Right. Well, we won't talk about the EMFs that we'll be exposed to by wearing these devices at all times. I was a victim of the Fitbit burn, so I'm not a fan of the Fitbit. I'll use this forum to spread the word. Take it off if you have one on, but hopefully they'll find something a little safer.
Yep.
But, you know, segueing that with the supplementation and then now into the labs, Can we talk a little bit about, you know, I frequently will have someone say, oh, I went to my doctor and, you know, they feel good and they just had their annual exam with some annual blood work and everything was fine, so I'm healthy. Or the other end of the spectrum, I feel horrible and I went to my doctor and all my labs are normal. So obviously when someone comes to functional medicine physicians, we're doing the functional test and that's where we find all these imbalances. But kind of in that same vein of, you know, with the RDA recommendations and the individualized, you know, amounts that we all need, you know, how about lab testing, the sort of more static, in-stage, standard labs with, you know, what we're using in a functional medicine practice? Can you, and what you're alluding to will become the future with these, you know, Fitbit devices and genetic testing?
Yeah, I think, again, that's a superb question. You know, I'm a registered, certified laboratory director, clinical laboratory director, so I've been involved with this whole concept of blood testing and serology for the better part of 40 years. And what we're witnessing, again, is a very significant change in how these tests are done. The tests that I grew up on, that most people have had done when they go to their doctor's office, are tests that really define the presence of disease. So they're what are called pathology tests. They really measure the presence of disease. So if you've had a heart attack or you have diabetes or you have kidney problems, these tests will be able to pick it up. There was a test added to the profile that everyone's familiar with when they have their blood chemistry done that is, however, different in terms of what it measures, and that is the blood cholesterol test. And the reason the blood cholesterol test is a kind of a different test of a different color is that if you asked what disease does high cholesterol diagnose, the answer is it doesn't diagnose any disease. That high cholesterol is not a diagnostic test for any disease. It's a risk factor for disease. So you might say high cholesterol is associated with a risk, statistical risk, based upon studies done at Framingham, Massachusetts, and others, for heart disease or a vascular disease. So it doesn't diagnose a disease. You cannot say because a person has high cholesterol that they have a disease any more than you can say that a person with low cholesterol has a disease. What you would say is both high and low cholesterols are associative risk factors for various diseases. Now, that's a whole different kettle of fish when you talk about risk factors versus the diagnosis of disease, because now you would say, well, what other kinds of things can you measure in the blood that are risk factors? Now, rather than call them risk factors, I would call them biomarkers of function. They tell you something about the function of the individual as a consequence of those being out of range. And these are different kinds of tests. And so now you say, well, can you give me another example of one of those? Yes. How about high sensitivity CRP? That's another biomarker that can be measured in the blood that people now are having done at their doctor's office. It doesn't diagnose a disease, but it does tell something about a chronic inflammatory state that is associated as a risk to disease. In fact, many diseases. And in the book, The Disease Delusion, I try to describe some of these common biomarkers that are assessing function, not just assessing disease, so that you can start reading, you know, your blood chemistries in a way that helps to see where you might are going rather than getting there to a disease and what you want to do to change the journey so that you're not going to be heading towards disease. How do you lower that hsCRP if it's elevated so that it won't present itself as either a heart attack or as a stroke or as arthritis? And I think these are the dominant new things that the functional medicine doctor is skilled in the art to know how to do, is to use these indicators of what I call the trajectory towards disease, the process of losing function so that we would get to disease, or changing function that results in disease. And when I say changing function, I again come back to these seven core principles I talked about, because those are the disturbances in our physiology that ultimately present as the some 10,000 different diseases that you find in the handbook of diseases. So you want to, rather than worry about 10,000 different diseases, you want to worry about disturbances of the seven core physiological processes. You get those resolved and those diseases are not present.
Great. Perfect. I have two more questions if you're willing.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Okay. One is, what are five changes that you'd make to, you know, our existing healthcare model to ensure that it becomes a more holistic or functional healthcare model?
Well, first of all, I think I would do what every doctor in our field would do, and that is I would develop an incentive through the reimbursement system to incent doctors to spend time with patients in the area of understanding function rather than just diagnosing disease. Right now, there's really no financial incentive because doctors are not reimbursed for spending time really talking about with their patient, talking about their dysfunction. So it's an economic disincentive to be involved in this field. And we know that for almost every industry or every business or every profession, that the professions tend to gravitate towards where the money is. So I think that we need to find a way to adequately and properly compensate doctors to be engaged in this type of healthcare. So that's number one. Number two is I think that we need a higher level of patient understanding of the role that they play in their own health, and to really get them to understand that that health is not a mystery. It's something that's actually locked up in their book of life that they can access, and there is probably nothing more valuable in life than feeling good, because it opens up every opportunity of enjoyment and quality of life. So I think helping people understand that they're more in control of their health than they thought. Number three is then changing the food supply system so that we get away from the food that's this shelf-stable, highly processed, high sugar, high fat, high additive food supply, and move into foods that you know, can be both, I would say, economically produced at a level that most people can afford and are tasty and available and look like they once grew in the ground and they were actually living at one time. I think if we get back to foods that really are closer to their origin and less processed, we would have a tremendous a step forward in the overall health patterns. Number four on the list, I think, is reminding people that these lifestyles that we have selected, which are these time-urgent, sedentary, locked in our computer, video game, the kind of Googleized life styles, need to be modified so that we're moving around and that we're getting back into activity. We're dancing with life. We're in rhythm. That our legs are there to actually give us the ability to move around and to be mobile, and our lungs and heart depend upon that movement for their function. So I think this whole concept of activity and making it fun and available and not sitting at 8 hours a day in a chair in front of our computer screen and not moving as a standard fare of our life needs to be changed. And then lastly, number five,
to stay in
I
touch
think
with
is
Dr.
recognizing
Myers,
that,
you can sign up for her newsletter.
That old adage of pay me now or pay me later is a very important thing to keep in mind. And people say I'm too busy to find a half an hour to myself to be thoughtful about life, to read poetry, to listen to music, to go for a walk, to just think about how marvelous it is to be alive. I just don't have the time to do that. And maybe if I'm lucky, I'll catch a week vacation a year and I can rush to do a power vacation to get my relaxation. I think that we need to find that if we don't find those times in our life and we don't schedule and engage ourselves in that as a priority, that we pay the price in a bigger way later. So it's not that we're going to save time. Sickness is a time waster. And days of absenteeism and feeling bad and getting things that you didn't have to get because you're so run down and your immune system is compromised because you never had a moment to relax and reduce your stress is a big outcome from not scheduling your life correctly. So I think that those five things, if we just put them on kind of a to-do list and started down the road in making them happen, would make huge changes in health patterns and health outcomes and reduce extraordinary high expenses for hospitalized care.
Yeah, I mean, I often talk to my patients, or, well, you know, why didn't my other doctor mention this to me? And I said, well, they're making money by keeping you sick, right? I mean, the insurance company, well, they might be losing some money, but, you know, the drug company is making money when you stay sick. You get to take their pills. The doctors are busy, you know, and the doctors are making money really off of procedures and things like that. I mean, if the person gets well, it's one less person in the clinic. You know, my model is to get people well, and then they excitedly go tell somebody else, and I get a new patient. Rather, you know, that's how you keep the system running, is by getting people well, and then hopefully we get everyone well. I was actually a Peace Corps volunteer. I can't even remember how many years ago it was, and at the time I didn't think anything of it. But as I'm writing my, you know, autoimmune book, thinking about everything that you were just saying about the, you know, the connection, the timeout, the sedentary lifestyle, or not having a sedentary lifestyle and eating real food. I was in rural Paraguay, and that's exactly what they did. I mean, I was out in the middle of nowhere working with farmers, and they worked, you know, hard manual labor every day. They made, you know, they grew their own food, ate it right then. They had amazing connections. If someone stopped over to visit, they stopped whatever they were doing and visited. And so a lot of the things that you're talking about, that's just what they did in their culture and in their society. I mean, they didn't have the computers and the cell phones and television. We barely even had electricity. And I don't remember anybody being sick with any kind of disease. I mean, I remember there being several villagers being in their 80s who now actually are still alive. I've been in touch, and they still have not passed. So nobody died. I mean, what the number one killer there was some sort of injury, and the fact that, you know, we were 2 hours to the nearest, you know, local hospital and 7 hours to the main, you know, trauma hospital. And so that's what people died of, not, you know, or infection, but not from these chronic diseases. And, you know, it's living proof of that. And it's really something I didn't, you know, I just took for granted down there. But as I'm writing my book, and I agree with you with the causes of these chronic illnesses, you know, in seeing how these play such a role in our lifestyle here, and how there are societies all over the world becoming fewer and fewer, but are actually living long, healthy lives because they don't have a lot of the lifestyle changes that we have here in the United States.
Yeah, I think that this medicine that we're talking about, this functional medicine, although there is a very sophisticated component of it, as you're talking about, these seven core physiological processes and these biomarkers and analyzing, you know, trends towards disease and matching genetic needs with lifestyle. That sounds sophisticated, but there's another part of it that's really very simple. It's rules of reasonableness. It's going back to core principles of treating a person, treating each of us with respect, and being involved with the human enterprise of eating right, living right, thinking right, breathing right. So there. Some of it's very sophisticated, but others of it is very easily implementable. I tried hard in the disease delusion to find that balance between, okay, here is the extraordinary discovery, the epic revolution of information we're going through today, but here's how it can be accessed fairly simply by people. You don't have to become a medical expert to really start getting the benefits of this extraordinary revolution.
So since most people don't have access to a functional medicine physician, and they are going to be sort of going through the conventional medical maze, what are some questions that you recommend that people ask to figure out, are they, you know, in the right place?
Yeah, I think that, again, that's very well said, because as I mentioned earlier, the questions you ask are the answers you're going to get. So my thought is that when a person is having a discussion with their doc, they should be asking questions about what's your impression of the importance of things like what I eat, how I live, where I, what I do, my exercise patterns, my stress patterns, how much does that become a role, or at least a part of how you're going to suggest the specific therapeutics for me? If those questions don't come up, or that those discussions are never had, or if they appear very superficial, like 5 seconds in a 6-minute office visit, just to kind of get them out of the way, then you're probably never going to get down to the depth of engagement that's required to really make this information worthwhile for you as a patient. So what you're really dealing with is a doc who's going to be there to treat your diseases when they occur, but probably not a doc that's going to assist you in getting to the point where disease, preventing disease before it occurs. So my feeling is, I think a a patient can easily and politely kind of query their doctor relative to what's their impression as it pertains to the things that we've been discussing. And if the answers are, well, you know, that's not really the central issue of concern that I have. I'm just here to make sure you're not diseased, and when you are, I'll give you the right medicine. Then that's a different approach, and it's probably not going to answer these things that we're talking about as it relates to the functional medicine outcome.
Yeah, this reminds me of a recent story. My father recently had a hip replacement and ended up with a Pseudomonas infection on the hip replacement, and of course that creates a biofilm, and I wasn't sure could it create a biofilm within the muscle as well. And so I was having this debate with I was asking my stepmother, and she said, well, the doctors, you know, told me this, and that it can only be a biofilm on the actual hip replacement. I said, okay, well, here, let's assess their understanding of biofilms. So just simply go back and ask them, do they know if there's a biofilm in the gut, and what do they think about the biofilms in the gut? And luckily they did, but I was like, okay, what's like a nice way to try to assess this person's understanding of like my understanding of biofilms and whatnot? So I just had to throw that in of, you know, my little query as to where is this infectious disease doctor coming from and what is their sort of stance overall? So I knew, did I need to do more digging or investigating, or is this a person that I really felt like, you know, did have a really, you know, an understanding of that?
Yeah, I think that that's a very, very, very good point, that we're not asking patients to become medical experts. That's, you know, we have people like yourself that are well-trained to be those experts. But we're hopefully going to have a higher literacy as it relates to average people's understanding of their own body. Because in the end, we who live in our bodies know more about it than any one doctor will ever know, because we live in a 24/7, 365, and we just have to learn more how to read the appropriate things and become cognizant of what's going on so that we will become a better advocate for our own health. And I think this is where the asking the right questions becomes so important, and that's really why again, in my book, Disease Delusion, I try to have these 8 questionnaires to get people to understand some of the questions that they might want to be asking themselves, so they'll know how to be better advocates with their doctor.
Right, right. One final question, if you're willing. I typically ask all of my guests this. It's on topic, but slightly off topic, because nutrition plays such a role in health. I typically ask all my guests what they eat in a typical day. Would you be willing to answer that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm a kind of a fairly simple guy as it relates to my diet. I'm not a vegetarian in terms of being a vegan, but I tend toward a more vegetable, plant food-based diet. Because I live in the Pacific Northwest, we eat quite a bit of seafood here, so my protein really is more seafood-related. I'm not a kind of a terrestrial protein guy myself. And I try to stay away from anything that's white. I try to keep with foods that are colored, like vegetables and fruits and things that were legumes and whole grains. And I'm not a person who has a very serious concern personally about gluten, so I do include cereal grain-based products, whole grains in my diet in moderation. And, you know, I obviously stay away from all sweetened beverages and soft drinks, and I'm also kind of stay away from too much in the way of fruit juice, because that's another concentrated form of sugar. So I tend to try to avoid concentrated sugars to the extent possible. I'm not a dessert a day type guy. And I try to basically make sure that my calorie intake kind of matches my daily energy expenditure. So, you know, I try to learn about what hunger means and try not to force hunger into a stress eating and stay with hunger as it relates to needs for calories in days of high activity output, and days where there's low activity output, try to moderate my diet appropriately. So it's really just a kind of a feedback process I've learned over the years, and I think that's what's helped protect me as I've, you know, traveled these 6 million miles, because obviously I've been exposed to all sorts of airplane food and all sorts of hotels and things of that nature. And so you have to develop your own health promotion program quickly, or you don't make it over 40 years of traveling. So I think my program is fairly simple, but it's built on these core principles.
That was fun. I appreciate that. I definitely learned something about you. I always learn something about my guests whenever they, you know, and I've been quite surprised at what people have said over the times that I've asked them. So thanks for sharing that. So the disease delusion, I'm having tongue-tied today with my D's. The disease delusion is not actually out yet. You're in pre-sales, correct? Or actually, I think when we produce this, it will be out. So it will be available at all major retailers.
Yes, yeah, it's actually released on the 6th of May, and it will be available in all major bookstores and obviously on Amazon. And, you know, we hope that it gets a little bit of interest because I think it has news to use for people who are really in the process of designing and implementing their own health promotion program.
Absolutely. So is there anything that you feel like, you know, we didn't have a chance to talk about regarding the book, that you, any kind of parting words that you want to say? I mean, I can say I read it. It's really fascinating. Dr. Bland is as incredible in terms of his wealth of knowledge as you've heard from this podcast. So I do encourage everybody to pick up a copy of it. There'll be something in there for you to learn and, you know, take with you to your doctor. That's really what we're talking about here, because we know that functional medicine has grown incredibly, but still isn't to the place where I'm sure both of us would like it to be, where everybody has access to this. So things that you can do while still navigating that conventional medicine realm. And anything that you'd like to say, Dr. Bland, about the book that we didn't cover?
No, Dr. Myers, I think this really has been fun for me, and I think it's an excellent series of questions you've posed, and hopefully the listeners got something news to use out of it, and I've enjoyed it immensely.
Great. Well, I absolutely appreciate you being on the call. And is there also, just in terms of ways that people can get in touch with you through the, you know, your website or Facebook page, anything that you want to give us here? And we'll, of course, post those in the blog as well. Anything with the Personal Lifestyle Medicine Institute?
Yeah, they can go to jeffreybland.com. That's jeffreybland.com. Or they can go to our Personalized Lifestyle Medicine Institute, which is plminstitute.org is our Personalized Lifestyle Medicine Institute website. So plminstitute.org or jeffreybland.com.
And the disease delusion, everybody pick up a copy. Thank you again, Dr. Bland. It was an absolute honor and privilege. And I just literally could go to tears just to say thank you in general for your work. I mean, I would not, I myself had autoimmune and have recovered through, you know, through the help of functional medicine and Mark Hyman, and then, you know, obviously have changed my entire career and devoted my life to this. So if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't have the opportunity to do this and to help, you know, reverse and prevent so many other people from chronic diseases and autoimmune diseases. So you are a blessing, and I appreciate you.
Well, it's because of people like you that I feel that the last 40 years has been worthwhile. So thank you so much, and keep up the great work. It's a privilege working with you.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.